We're back on the road with our sixth live taping episode. And leaders, I know this episode is long, but we know y'all love some 2020 action, and we also wanted to give you a primer before these final days of the 2019 legislative session. For this episode, we taped in front of a crowd of dedicated whip crack head leaders at Rock Hill Brewing Company last Thursday in Rock Hill. I mean, Rock Thrill. If you missed it, don't worry, because guess what? We are planning additional live tapings. Drop us a line on social media at SCLeadPod on Twitter or Instagram, and let us know where you think we should show up next. But without further ado, let's get into the pod. Welcome to the South Carolina Lead, a podcast that breaks down state political news for you and provides insight on legislative happenings under the Statehouse Dome in Columbia. Hello, I'm your host, Gavin Jackson, and this episode is for the week of May 7th, 2019. Say hello, Rock Hill Brewing Company! That's right. We're live at Rock Hill. We got a great crowd. Great crowd to talk about this last week of the 2019 legislative session. Now, we're not going to do a full recap in this episode. We'll save that for next week. But we do want to catch up on some things, including all things education, the House passage of the Fetal Heartbeat Bill, the future of Santee Cooper, the Panthers incentive bill, and the impact of Joe Biden entering the 2020 race. So we got a lot to cover. The Lead is a podcast where we go behind the headlines with the reporters who wrote the stories affecting you. Every Tuesday, we give you a roundup of news, insight into the week's biggest stories, campaign trail intrigue, and a chaser of trivia. Now, you can listen to all four sections of our podcast instead of trying to convince people that Rock Hill isn't Charlotte Light. It's Rock Thrill, y'all. We know it's... Or while you enjoy these last few days before it gets too hot outside. It's already getting there. Also, invite the Lead to your most recent pool party. We do pool parties.
Bring us out.
Yeah. We'll be there. And without further ado, it's time for our brief quorum call. Quorum call is a term to see if there's a majority present. But here in the South Carolina Lead, we know a majority of the time that you're not always current with the news. So here's a quick recap of several top stories you should know about. And surprise, we're in the studio doing this portion of the podcast, mainly because if you've ever come to some of our live tapings, it kind of chews up a good bit of our time with the audience. So we decided to do this segment in studio. So here are those top stories. Number one, the Greenville News reports that state utility regulators reduced a proposed rate increase that would have affected 591,000 Duke Energy customers in the upstate and called executives of the energy company, quote, tone deaf for the proposal. Duke Energy requested last year to increase its residential basic facilities rate charge from $8.29 to $28. The company later agreed to lower that charge to either $11.70 or $13.09. The Public Service Commission is expected to announce a final decision on the rate increase in coming weeks. And number two, some more utility news with a boondoggle update. The Post and Courier reports that a consortium that includes domestic and foreign companies is interested in buying the two abandoned nuclear reactors in Fairfield County and finishing the project that once promised to usher in a new wave of clean energy in the country. This according to a state lawmaker. Consortium representatives visited the site 35 miles north of Columbia last month with leaders from the state-owned utility Santee Cooper, the project owner, this according to State Senator Larry Grooms of Charleston. Grooms declined to name the members of the consortium, but only say they include U.S. and South Korean companies. Now, some state leaders do cast doubt about the offer to buy VC summer reactors that were estimated to cost more than $20 billion to complete. Number three, and this isn't our Florida Man segment, by the way, but the Associated Press reports that a Florida man has been sentenced to a year in prison for his part in a reptile smuggling ring that stretched from South Carolina to Hong Kong. Matthew Harrison Kale was sentenced for the scheme that involved hiding rare turtles in candy wrappers or socks and shipping them overseas. Prosecutors say Kale was a key part of the operation, which was led in South Carolina by Stephen Varen Baker. Baker of Georgia was ordered in March to serve just over a year in prison, and authorities have said that Baker is one of South Carolina's most well-known wildlife traders. Weird flex. And number four, the Post and Courier reports that federal and state agents removed evidence from the Chester County Sheriff's Office during a surprise raid that suggests Sheriff Alex Underwood is under scrutiny. The newspaper could not reach him for comment, and this raid comes after the newspaper's Above the Law investigation that showed how some sheriffs misused their positions. You can listen back to a previous episode we did on that on iTunes or wherever you find podcasts. Now, the investigation revealed that Underwood used public money to fly first class to sheriff's conferences with his wife, hire pricey airport chauffeurs, and upgrade his hotel rooms. Now, the sheriff defended the upgrades because of his 6'4" stature. And for our news segment, Florida Man News. Every week, we give you just a headline, a taste of the most captivating Florida Man news there is. This week's headline, drunk Florida man kicked out of library, told cops he was Jason Bourne. Unknown if that will be a trilogy. And just like my ability to enter any public library in the country, because of my number of outstanding books I have, we buried the lead. Shout out to the State Library. Great Instagram account to follow. Great memes. So like I said at the top, we're taping this in Rock Hill on Thursday. Session just went long today, but it just wrapped up. Senators passed a bill dealing with the future of Santee Cooper after several days of debate. But that was just one thing that happened in the State House over the past few days. You might have heard of a little thing called the Teachers Rally, which brought about 10,000 teachers and supporters to the State House. They got some love in the House. It was a very huge rally. I was out there. It was a huge turnout. But it's almost seen a little too much too late at this point, since it seems like the overall bill will stay stuck in the Senate till next January. The money is in the budget. And we also catch you up on what's coming next for that fetal heartbeat abortion bill that did pass the House recently. And also, with 3 legislative days left, will the Senate finally pass that Panthers incentive bill? And there it is. Yeah, I didn't tell you about that Panther one right there. I forgot about it there for a minute. And also, we're going to talk a little bit of 2020 with Joe Biden. We went from a Biden watch to a Biden warning to where now we're a Category 1 Biden storm.
Certified Biden storm.
It's hit in South Carolina this weekend. So much to talk about. That's why I brought Jamie Lovegrove with the Post and Courier and Jeffrey Collins with the Associated Press. Guys, thanks for being here with us.
Thank you, Gavin. Hey,
glad to be here.
So just kind of starting off, we're going to talk about Santee Cooper. I know it's been a pretty long slog when it comes to all things utilities in South Carolina, but it's kind of been the dominant headline for the past few weeks. Lawmakers have been kind of debating the future of it, how best to handle it. Should they sell it? Should they reform it? Should they get a manager for it? It's a little in the weeds, but they did just make some action on it today. Jamie, you were kind of watching some of that debate. Kind of fill us in about what's going on with the future of Santee Cooper and what senators might be doing there.
Yeah, so they, just a couple hours before we got here, they passed a bill 42-1. Senator Larry Grooms, whose district includes Monk's Corner, where Santee Cooper's headquarters is basically the only one who was opposed to it. But they passed this legislation to begin soliciting actual bids for Santee Cooper, so utilities from elsewhere around the country can start actually, you know, outlining the full specific details, you know, how much they're willing to pay for it. And it laid out a bunch of different conditions about how the process is going to go. They're going to hire a firm to solicit these bids and to start going about this process. So it is very inside baseball, in the weeds in some ways, but it is just a sign that the Senate is serious about beginning the process of considering the sale of Santee Cooper, and it's not stopping here.
Well, and Jeffrey, that bill has been on priority status in the Senate. It's called special order, so the Senate can set bills in special order, and that's all they talk about, and that's what they've been kind of stuck with for the past 6 days. So it's interesting to see that now it's moving forward, but we have 3 legislative days left. There's a possibility we might come back for a special session to look at these bids that Jamie was talking about. But, I mean, is it too late now to kind of do other things in the Senate too, or is there plenty of time left with 3 legislative days left to do things?
It depends on whether the Senate wants to do anything or not. I mean, there's 3 legislative days, and there are things that they can do. I mean, we're going to talk a little bit later about the Panthers. That's obviously one thing that's floating out there, and there are some other things that they can get to, but, you know, they let this thing go for, they lost 2 legislative weeks, 6 days, so it seems somewhat apparent that there weren't a lot of things that they really, really wanted to do or get to. And the thing with Santee Cooper is this was kind of like negotiating the terms of the first date. I mean, this was just, hey, let's figure out what we could do. I mean, they still have to figure out what they're going to do, and that's going to be the mother of all debates when that happens. I mean, when they finally do get around to deciding what the true future of Santee Cooper is, that now you thought the 6 days was a long debate?
We all lived through the road bill debate.
Yeah. You know, you started to get a little sense once, Senate Education Committee Chairman Greg Hembree, once he started to kind of parse this bill out and have, you know, almost a dozen subcommittee meetings and hearings on it, you kind of got the sense that this thing was going to slow down considerably. You know, and obviously, you know, we had the teacher rally,
yeah,
and, you know, 10,000 people show up, which was the biggest rally I can recall at the State House,
yeah,
since King Day at the Dome in 2000, not the 2015 one, but the 2000 one. And, you know, it you could tell the momentum was starting to stall out a little bit. But again, you know, if you're talking about what the Senate and the House, the whole General Assembly has done this year, haven't accomplished a whole lot of things. I mean, not big, significant things. Yeah. They're kicking some cans down the road, it seems like. So
2020 is going to be a blast. I'm already looking forward to it. But Jamie, kind of just talking what Jeffrey's talking about when we talk about education now, obviously it was a huge rally out there. I mean, teachers from all over. And again, there's a lot of stuff in the budget for these teachers too. You know, there's money, there's pay raises, there's money for infrastructure for high poverty districts, mental health counselors, SROs. So a lot of money going this year, and even McMaster's alluded to having more money next year for teachers. But is that enough? I mean, these teachers just kind of wanted to sound like they just want to have some respect from lawmakers. Did they get that? Are lawmakers listening to them? I mean, they couldn't not notice all those teachers outside.
They certainly noticed. They could literally hear it. You know, I was inside the House chamber at one point, and you could hear the cheers from outside, you know, the roar of outside. I talked to Governor McMaster in his office at one point during the rally, and you could hear it inside his office.
Yeah.
So there was no doubt that they were quite aware of the spectacle that was going on outside. You know, my sense is that lawmakers don't know exactly what the message from the teachers was, other than frustration with the status quo.
Mm-hmm.
And there is disagreement about a bunch of different things, about how much, you know, emphasis should be placed on the speed of process versus the quality. And Hembree, for example, the chairman of the Senate Education Committee, has really focused on making sure that whatever ends up passing is a good bill, and has said, I don't want to rush this process. I want to make sure that whatever we do is going to be a successful product, whereas the governor and the House have really said that there's an urgency here and we need to get something done this calendar year, and there's been some talk in the last couple of days about putting it in the sign-you-die resolution at the end of the session to potentially bring back the legislature at some point this year. So the question is sort of where exactly all of that energy that was very clear for everyone to see yesterday goes. I, you know, at the very beginning of this session, they put off what is really the biggest question, which is the funding formula.
Again, save it for 2020. It's going to be a fun year.
Exactly. It's an election year, and they're going to be dealing with the most difficult and thorniest issue in education. So it's going to be fascinating to see where they go with that.
Jeffrey, you want to jump
well,
in?
Well, and, you know, talking about what the next step is or how to deal with this, South Carolina hasn't had to deal very often with a group of people from one occupation. I mean, you know, obviously, we're not a union state. We're 50th in union participation in South Carolina. And, you know, and teachers can't unionize, but it's one of those deals where, you know, they're not used to seeing this power group of people. And it'd be interesting. I mean, you know, the SE for Ed is the organization that put together this march. They're a very loose organization. I mean, they just kind of formed online. They're still trying to feel their way through advocacy and everything. So lots could change. I mean, I found it interesting that they did it in May. I wonder what will happen if they have something similar in January of next year, because I got the sense there might have been more school districts closed if it was in January and they had that built-in day that they could have taken off, as opposed to May when they were all trying really, really hard not to miss a day this close to the end of school.
Yeah.
So, you know, that'll be interesting to see. And, you know, South Carolina and teachers, you know, the General Assembly's always had a little bit of conflict with them. I mean, I learned from listening to Walter Edgar's Journal a couple years ago, I learned that, you know, back in the very early part of the season.
He's angling for
that. I know, I'm looking for that. I want it. No, but I learned from listening to him that back in the early days of the Civil Rights Movement, you know, South Carolina made it illegal or allowed, you know, districts to fire teachers who joined the NAACP. I mean, that was taking away their voice to a certain extent too. So this will be a very interesting thing to see how this group of teachers and how the legislators kind of go at it this during the off session, and to see if they decide to hit the button again and put more pressure on when 2020 session starts.
Well, and Jamie, to that end, we're talking about the politics of this whole protest. I mean, we did see Speaker Lucas gave some comments during the rally the other day. Superintendent of Education Molly Spearman was substituting in one of the classrooms in the area schools because the teachers leaving, and she was not in favor of the march. I mean, what's the political fallout? I was wondering, I was thinking, you know, I guess it's good that it's not an election year for people like constitutional officers, because it could be really, it would have been a huge conflict for her if this had happened last year in election year too.
Yeah, there was a very...
And the governor was kind of middle, I mean, he kind of advocated with the teachers
there
too.
There was not a very coordinated messaging, and that was part of the issue. You know, we had Speaker Lucas at the beginning of the day, you know, kind of almost taking offense from the rally and saying we did our best and you know, it's the Senate's fault and we should start moving forward on this and, you know, there's misinformation out there. The governor was saying he understands the frustration of the teachers. He's frustrated too and really directing his frustration at the Senate and saying the Senate needs to pass something. You had Superintendent Spearman going and substituting. You had Chairman of the Senate Education Committee, Greg Hembree, went to go substitute as well. And that decision actually brought a lot of the ire towards them. You had folks out there chanting, "Where is Molly?" At Molly Spearman, the superintendent of education. So I think it took a lot of the statewide political officers by surprise. I don't think they expected that 10,000 teachers, you know, people have been quite passionate about this issue for some time. And this really came to a head, and I don't think that folks realized just the extent of it, and certainly, if nothing else, that's what yesterday proved.
And then, you know, we have this, to switch gears from education, because that's still going to be an ongoing issue. We're going to be seeing that well into next year, and so another issue we'll be seeing well into next year is the abortion debate. Jeffrey, I think you, AT, you might have told me that you called it, Jeffrey, in the beginning when we had you on the beginning of this the podcast, was that
in Columbia he called
it. That it was going to be an issue that would crop up, and it was not an issue for most of the session. It was kind of just, and it was so much else going on with education and such. And then towards the end we did see that fetal heartbeat abortion ban come up, which would ban abortions around 6 weeks once the heartbeat's detected. And we saw that in other states. We saw that pass in Georgia. We've seen it pass in other states in the South too. It did pass the House of Representatives in South Carolina, but what's its future right now? Again, we keep talking about what's going to happen in 2020. It sounds like 2020 is going to be a banner year for all things politics in South Carolina, so I'm going to start sleeping now. But what should we expect going forward in the Senate with this bill?
Well, you know, the heartbeat abortion bill did pass the House. It has gone over to the Senate, obviously 3 days left, and they intentionally waited until after the crossover deadline. So they're not going to do anything with it these last 3 days of session. But, you know, everything in 2000, it's a two-year General Assembly session in South Carolina. So everything just freezes in place on May the 9th when they adjourn, and it starts out in the same place next year. So the heartbeat abortion bill will be waiting for a Senate committee hearing when we come around January 2020. Part of the reason that they didn't continue to push it forward is it had a very uncertain to negative future in the Senate. The Senate is less conservative than the House. You know, last year they couldn't get a similar kind of thing through. You know, Senator Brad Hutto, a Democrat out of Orangeburg, pulled a little legislative maneuver where he kind of gave people that are really pushing hard for an abortion ban everything they wanted. He changed the bill to ban abortion, essentially. But they couldn't do it because suddenly those Republican senators who aren't quite that far to that point couldn't pull it off. Well, they figured that was going to happen again this year. There would be a filibuster, so they waited it out. We'll see. I mean, there's a lot of stuff to do in 2020. I'll bring up my 2020 speech. I mean, you know, there's going to be folks want to deal with the education funding formula. Folks like Representative Pope are going to want tax reform to come to the forefront in 2020. You know, you got all the senators and all the House members up for re-election. Like you said, get to sleep. Get a nice rest. You know, January 2020 is coming.
And we also got February 29th, our primary.
And then you got,
You know, if you know, every senator is up for re-election next year, along with the House. And, you know, if folks have Republican primary challengers and there's a big abortion bill in the Senate, that's going to put some pressure on some of them if they're getting challenged from the right. And
unless you wait till after filing.
Well, you know, you can wait as long, but even if you're waiting, you know, folks can use that against you as the fact that you're stalling. It is over there now. You know, we are at a very different situation than we were at last year, because last year you could just run out the clock and it would be over. This year you're going to have a whole nother year of session to deal with it. So it's going to be hanging over them from day one, from, you know, January 6th, 7th, 2020. I mean, you know, there are Republican senators who, and Republican House members, who wanted that kind of point of pride. They wanted the case in the Supreme Court to be Roe versus South Carolina. Mm-hmm. It has been interesting to watch other states move forward with it. The Senate has this great respect for the institution of filibusters.
Yeah, we saw that, yeah.
It is hard to sit folks down, and the numbers are basically right on the edge whereby you need two-thirds of the Senate to sit any lawmaker down when they are filibustering. You mm-hmm. can sit someone down while they're up there if two-thirds of the Senate votes to do it. Republicans control about two-thirds of the Senate, but the problem is a couple of them, namely Finance Chairman Hugh Leatherman, Judiciary Chairman Luke Rankin, you know, very powerful folks, mm-hmm. are very respectful of the
deliberative body,
of the norms of the Senate, and they do not want to do that. And so, you know, we see episodes like we saw last year where the Senate at 1:30, 2 o'clock in the morning, you know, ends up failing to sit these filibusters down, and they decide to adjourn, and that's the end of the abortion debate. So, mm-hmm. We keep seeing that over and over again, and the question is, are we going to see that one final time in 2020, or are things going to change?
I want to switch, since we are in Rock Hill, and we are going to wrap up this discussion soon. I know it's so much fun. A fun bill, well, that has a good sound if I don't know if it's a fun bill, but the Panthers bill.
Wow!
There we go. Is still in the Senate. It did pass the House, and it's an incentive bill to kind of, you know, help bring the, you know, the Carolina Panthers to the Rock Hill area. I forgot I just said that. You know, bring the headquarters here, bring the practice facilities here, and it was stuck behind, like we were saying, the Santee Cooper bill, and there were objections on that, the Panthers incentive bill as well. So, Jamie, now that things have kind of been moving through the Senate, what's the future for that bill with 3 days left?
So the situation was the Panthers bill could have moved forward as soon as this week. The issue was that Dick Harpootlian, a Democrat from Columbia.
We are in Rock Hill.
We're not in Columbia anymore.
Stay close.
You know, he has had this hold on this bill for several weeks now because he's been in this back and forth with the governor's office and with the Commerce Department, basically disputing the numbers that they've been putting out about the economic benefits of this deal. He basically claims that more or less that they're kind of pulling these numbers out of thin air and that, you know, it's not going to be as beneficial to the state as they're claiming, and it's not worth $115 million in tax breaks for the Panthers to do it. He was willing to bring his hold off the bill this week, but his condition was he wanted to have 15 minutes on the Senate floor to explain his opposition to the package, incentives package.
Everyone deserves their 15 minutes.
He just wanted his 15 minutes to lay out the case against the incentives package. The issue was Santee Cooper took out the whole week, and so he couldn't get a chance to do that. So I expect he'll do that on Tuesday, and then he'll remove his hold, and then we'll see where the vote is.
Yeah.
He feels like the vote is probably pretty close. I think everyone agrees that there is, you know, somewhere in the teens of opposition and somewhere in the 20s of support. So it seems like it's likely to pass at the end of the day. I was just speaking to House Majority Leader Gary Simrell before here, and he said that, you know, that the Panthers are not going to come unless this passes. And I think Charlotte has gotten the sense that if this doesn't pass, they have a chance to keep the Panthers practice facility and headquarters up there. So it is going to matter. I think it is most likely going to pass, and I think we are going to see the Panthers come down here, but it has been a long process after passing the House very quickly.
And Jeffrey, just to kind of quickly wrap up on the Panthers bill, you know, did that on purpose. We did see it's a bipartisan opposition in some respects too. Like Jamie's saying, it could be a teen vote there, you know, obviously prevailing vote, but still a dissension with a good bit of people. You know, Senate Majority Leader Shane Massey was telling me on This Week in South Carolina that it's a kind of a bitter pill for people to swallow, because there will be a good bit of infrastructure investment, you know, interchange and roads being created. And it's kind of hard for some people in the Senate to back such things when their roads and their infrastructure and their districts isn't up to par. And here we are, you know, kind of rolling out the carpet in a sense for a group that's, like he said, not exactly a Boeing. It's not bringing the Boeing level jobs and investment. So how do they kind of weigh that when you're looking at this in economic investment, which sometimes it seems like they rubber stamp these big projects in a sense in South Carolina.
Well, incentives are tricky things. I mean, you're always going to hear the pro incentive people say, hey, Boeing, hey, BMW. Well, for the Boeings and BMWs, there's some other things on the other side. And it just popped in my head. I can't remember the exact name of it, but there was a bakery that they gave some incentives to in Greenville that was supposed to bring, hundreds, if not thousands of jobs. It just didn't pan out. But I mean, every state that does this kind of thing has winners and losers. And I think what you see the opposition trying to do is, I think, A, there's an effort to kind of modernize the process. I mean, I think part of that huge report that Dick Harpootlian got pulled together kind of showed that, they're using formulas and some assumptions that maybe were worked 15, 20 years ago that aren't quite modern now. So I think, they're trying to pull a more modern analysis into this. And I think also that, they want to be able to weigh each one of these individually. But there is a very good point to be made. I mean, I have a feeling that when the Senate comes up after Dick Harpootlian speaks, or maybe before, you're going to hear somebody, along the lines of, some of the folks down in Charleston or somewhere like that, talk about, well, how far away is Rock Hill? Daryl Jackson, was discussing, well, what does this do for my Columbia district? It doesn't do hardly anything. I can see Boeing. Yeah. I can see suppliers. I can see a chain. But, this is just, and they're going to say it something like this, these are just players and coaches driving down from their huge mansions in Charlotte across the state line, working for whatever, for a few hours, then driving back. I mean, the opposite view is they can build huge complex. They can have hotels and an entertainment district. They can have other things that,
supports more economic development in the area.
Yeah, but that's going to be the back and forth that you pull. It'll be interesting to see not only what the vote is, but how it falls in geographic and party lines.
And just briefly, the can of worms that this process has opened in some ways is that Dick Harpootlian now and about a dozen senators have requested a Legislative Audit Council review of the last 10 years of all economic incentives deals. They want to see what has South Carolina gotten out of all of these millions of dollars, billions of dollars that we've spent trying to lure companies to come here. So now there's going to be actually greater oversight in some ways of what the Commerce Department is doing on a whole bunch for a whole bunch of different companies as well. You may be getting a short-term gain, but a long-term pain in some ways.
I want to jump off that really quick and jump into 2020 since we're running long. And since we won't have a campaign trail today, we're gonna rope this in right here. We're going to talk about Joe Biden. We're all battening down the hatches for Joe since the Category 1 storm is in effect. Jamie, Biden has seen a good bump in the polls. He's been leading the polls ever since, he's been out of this race. But it's interesting to say, because I want to drill down a little bit more on that CNN poll that came out this week. When you look at the white voters, Biden has a 29% support among them. Sanders has 15%, Buttigieg has 10. And when you look at among non-white voters, Biden's share jumps to 50%. So these are some solid numbers for Joe Biden, especially coming into South Carolina where he's campaigning this Saturday, this weekend in South Carolina. Yeah. He must be pretty optimistic on where he stands at least.
Absolutely. It is his race to lose, I think, pretty clearly at this point. By the time folks are listening to this podcast, he will have already come. He's coming on Saturday. He's coming to Columbia. He's going to do a public event at the Hyatt Park Community Center and then do a fundraiser at Dick Harpootlian's house. Mm-hmm. Dick Harpootlian is a big Biden supporter. I've heard this out on the trail a bunch as I've been going to other candidates. As voters have been checking out Democratic presidential candidates, they have often said to me, I'm interested in this person. I'm interested in Kamala Harris. I'm interested in Cory Booker. I'm interested in Pete Buttigieg and Beto O'Rourke. But, if Biden gets in the race, that's going to be kind of a game changer for me. He just exudes a level of experience that the other candidates in the race don't have. He, of course, is close associations by being the vice president with President Obama, who remains very popular among the Democratic electorate in South Carolina. So it's going to take something kind of dramatic, I think, for him to lose the support that he has. And I think it's beneficial to Biden to have a now, as of this morning, a 21 candidate Democratic primary field. Yeah. Michael Bennett, the senator from Colorado, announced this morning that he's going to run. So we have 21 candidates now. They're all dividing up a lot of the vote. Mm-hmm. And Biden has kind of a floor of support right now of, well north of 30%. Yeah. And I think he is the known commodity in a field of many unknowns. Yeah. So he is starting out with a huge advantage.
And we'll start seeing that field get whittled down more and more, too. Like we said, 2016, we did have 6 Republicans on the ticket. So I'm assuming that's maybe a basis we can work off of looking forward. But Jeffrey, I know you're not covering 2020 as much as your colleague Meg Kennard is. Hey, Meg. But tell me, do you have some thoughts on this, too?
Please don't make me name all 21 candidates. I'm going to fail if that's the test for today.
I'm covering it, and I don't think I could name all 21.
But I think the nice thing about South Carolina's spot in the primary calendar is if you want to meet a presidential candidate, you can meet them one-on-one. Yeah. And that's the beautiful thing about living in this state. I mean, there's 5 million people here, but there's the campaign here is going to be a very retail 1920s stump meeting, go out and meet the people kind of thing. Yeah. And so, you know, what a wonderful opportunity that is. I mean, you can meet anybody you want.
Despite Biden's lead, again, it's not a lock. It's not like
everyone else is trying
so
really hard.
Voters
too. He's the only one you're not probably going to be able to get close to. It has been fascinating watching in the early days of his campaign. Mm-hmm. It's almost like he is the president in some ways. He has Secret Service with him. He has a press pool. It's so different from the rest of the candidates who are showing up at these very small events, mm-hmm. you know, intimate crowds, getting to meet everybody in person. Biden is kind of a whole different phenomena with a whole different campaign. It's like he is the nominee already in some ways.
Yeah, because do you just drop into Denmark with your Secret Service
right.
detail like
it's
you do?
Sort of, you know, he can't appear. He is difficult. Famous, whereas some of these candidates are not famous. Mm-hmm.
Which gives him the advantage because he doesn't have to explain himself at the same time, too. So definitely a lot. And again, Rock Hill, fifth largest city in South Carolina, is also getting a lot of more traction. You guys are seeing a lot of candidates coming through here, too.
Yeah.
So it's very interesting.
Just 100 feet away from here, we had Beto O'Rourke, what, 3-4 weeks ago in a packed Amelie's Cafe. And, we had Pete Buttigieg come up here. And I think that the crowds that we've seen in Rock Hill are going to make more candidates want to come here. Mm-hmm. And I think that's actually something that the candidates are figuring out is that North Carolina's primary is not very long after South Carolina's primary, and you can get voters from Charlotte to come down to events in Rock Hill, and I saw that at Beto's event. You know, you had a lot of Charlotte Democrats coming down and seeing these, so you can actually kill two birds with one stone if you come to Rock Hill.
Well, and you can get TV crews coming down from that suburb of Rock Hill, Charlotte, up there to the north, too.
And we've seen
Rock Hill.
We'll end on that. We'll take that to the bank. Take that, Charlotte, Queen City.
Yeah.
All right. Well, again, a big, great discussion here. And again, all eyes on 2020, more ways than one. So we'll be keeping up, and we're going to be wrapping up the session next week. We're going to plan on having a special Signy Die episode, a little mini pod. Woo. You guys might remember the mini pod we did for the election night. We're going to do one for Signy Die because it's the last day of session, May 9th. So we'll be doing that, and then we'll have our big recap episode, too. So everything that's in suspension, as we say. So again, thank you to Jeffrey Collins with the Associated Press and Jamie Lovegrove with the Post and Courier. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me, Gavin.
Thank you to this wonderful crowd.
Yeah.
Thank you for coming
out.
Appreciate it.
In our final section, Did You Know?, we focus on one quirky function of the state, politics, or government. It's named after the parliamentary procedure that lawmakers use when speaking to each other. And did you know that South Carolina Public Radio's Russ McKinney is back with some more great trivia? He is. Russ.
Glad to be here.
Welcome
to
Rock Hill.
Thank you.
And also, joining us is Senator Wes Clymer, also jumping on with us.
Thank you. You know what I say about the lead is you come for the Florida man and you stay for the trivia.
Oh, we might cover at that. And Senator Clymer, I know you said I told you about this, and you said this is one of items on your bucket list.
It is big bucket list item. We're checking it off.
That's what we need more of out there, lead listeners, dear leaders.
I want people to want to die after they do that.
I mean, again, it goes back to our statement about having lawmakers on the show. We don't usually have lawmakers on; we just have reporters on. But we do enjoy lawmakers on for things that aren't necessarily politically related.
You make special exceptions for the guys who drag you back to their hometowns.
There we go.
Is that what it is?
Yes. But we did have Micah Caskey on it when we had our live taping in Columbia, so we figured definitely have you on since we're up here
invitation.
In Rock Hill. So Russ is going to be asking a couple questions. What he'll do is ask the question, he'll go through the answers, and then we'll poll the audience because that helps me sometimes get the answer correct, which is convenient. So Russ, let's see what you got. Yeah.
Okay. Which of the following was instrumental in the creation of Rock Hill?
I'm watching the representatives out there too.
Okay. A, the Charlotte and South Carolina Railroad. B, the Fort Mill Ferry at the Catawba River. C, the Battle of Kings Mountain. D, the evacuation of citizens from the Lowcountry, Charleston in particular, during and after the Revolutionary War.
I like the battle.
All right. I actually do have an answer in my mind right now.
Okay.
So. Okay, read them off again, Russell. Let's see what everyone thinks.
Raise your hand. Charlotte and South Carolina Railroad, Fort Mill Ferry at the Catawba River, Battle of Kings Mountain, and the evacuation of citizens from the Charleston area during the during the Revolutionary War.
Okay, we'll do the railroad. I'm looking at
evacuation is very specific.
Yeah, I'm gonna go ahead and.
Yeah, it's the railroad.
I evacuated from Charleston to Rock Hill, so.
Take his microphone. It was the Charlotte and South Carolina Railroad.
We need a locomotive whistle right there.
Yeah, it was actually slated to go a little farther to the west, and there were some complaints about the noise and the smoke, so they moved it over this way and encountered a rise in the geological rise here, thus Rock Hill.
Huh? It's actually named after a rock.
I don't see people taking notes out there, but they should be taking notes, Russ. That's some good Rock Hill trivia right there, Russ.
Right,
you stumped
pleasure.
Us, and you also educated
I didn't
us.
Too many people.
Thanks, Russ.
Thanks.
That's it. Thank you, guys. Thank you, Senator. I appreciate it. And thanks again for everyone who came out to Rock Hill, and of course, Rock Hill Brewing Company. You guys are great, and we can't wait to get back up there. The South Carolina Lead is one of many ways SCETV wants to help keep you informed. Check out the latest news and live streams on scetv.org. Listen to coverage from South Carolina Public Radio and watch This Week in South Carolina, a show where I talk with the newsmakers of the week on SCETV, Fridays at 7:30 p.m. and Sundays at 11:30 a.m. All of that, this podcast, and more is available on SCETV's super easy-to-use app and southcarolinapublicradio.org. Subscribe to us, and we'll have a new episode for you every Tuesday on Apple Podcasts. Search us easily on your Android, the NPR One app, or wherever you find podcasts. Also, be sure to rate us and review us on iTunes, like our friends of the pod Moxie Megs and Holy City Center did the other day. Thank you, thank you, thank you! Follow us on Instagram at @scleadpod, and you can see photos from the studio, on assignment, and of course, our dank memes. We're also on Twitter with the same handle at @scleadepod. We have swag, sticker swag that is. Send us a direct message on Twitter or Instagram with your address, and we'll send one your way. Email questions, comments, or your gripes to scleade@scetv.org. The South Carolina Lead is produced in partnership with South Carolina ETV, South Carolina Public Radio, and a special thanks to the Post and Courier and the Associated Press. Our producer is A.T. Shire. Sean Birch is our supervising producer. Tom Posey is our executive producer. This episode was recorded and produced at Rock Hill Brewing Company in Rock Hill, South Carolina, on May 2nd, 2019. I'm Gavin Jackson. Thanks for listening. Secret message. All presidential candidates must disclose their AOL Instant Messenger screen names. Signed, GSJ2308. # sensible screen name. # longest secret message ever. Ever.